Mouthing Off is a theater, arts, and culture podcast from Bad Mouth Theater Company in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm Amanda Forstrom.
I'm Kevin Couchman.
And I'm Mari Sittner. Mouthing Off features compelling interviews and discussions with artists and creators from around the Twin Cities and beyond.
Tune in for something different online where you get your podcasts at badmouthtc.com and on the air in St. Paul through Frogtown Radio 94.1 FM.
And if you've got something going on around the Twin Cities you'd like to talk about, we want to hear from you. Email us at badmouthtc@gmail.com.
Mouthing Off is sponsored by Minnesota Playlist, the digital destination for live performing arts. Producers can find talent to work with, directors can cast productions with audition ads, teachers can find students with a classified, and audiences can find the perfect show to attend on the state's largest calendar of theater and dance shows. Find out more at minnesotaplaylist.com.
We hope you enjoy the show.
We're back with another episode of Mouthing Off, the theater arts and culture podcast for the Twin Cities and beyond. I'm Kevin Couchman, joined by my partners in whatever this is, Amanda Forstrom here in Minnesota. Amanda, how are you?
I'm fantastic. I'm really excited to talk to another history theater favorite. We love having those guys around and their guests on. It's awesome to talk about. So
we have so much history with history theater already in doing this pod. And then the great Mari Sittner in New York, but she's honorary Minnesotan. Mari Sittner. Mari, how are you?
I'm doing good. I mean, I always love talking to history theater, and I especially love when we pod when it's light outside. It is currently for you guys, it is 7 and it is light outside.
It is. I've got my new watch, my little watch that tells me that the sun is setting in exactly 12 minutes. So as soon as the sun sets, I'm going to jump in and say the sun is set. But that's neither here nor there. Our guest today is Pierce Bunting. Pierce, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. It's good to be here.
Fantastic. And Mari, why don't you kick it off with some questions here. We're very excited. We love having history theater people on. There's a production coming up. I want to hear all about it.
Yeah, I know that you're here to promote a new show at History Theater called A Unique Assignment. Do you want to give us your pitch?
Okay, well, let me tell you, it's in 1962, a young 23-year-old second lieutenant ROTC guy whose little mini tour was extended to 2 years from 6 months. He was originally from Minnesota, just came back from a cushy post in Camp Drum up in upstate New York. And all of a sudden, on the night of September 30th, about 30,000 troops were mobilized to go to Oxford, Mississippi by President Kennedy's directive because James Meredith, who was at the time, I think, 28-year-old black student enrolled in the University of Mississippi, which is an all-white university, is total, you know, white supremacy town. And he, through court orders, Supreme Court, President Kennedy backed him up, and he finally got enrolled where other people weren't able to before. And he was on a mission to it was his way of working inside the system rather than outside the system to get admitted to an all-white university. And he needed a lot of backup, and there were a lot of riots the night of September 30th and into October 1st, and right around that time, so many people gathered, 3,000, maybe more, gathered outside of Old Miss, and there was rioting and tear gas, and people were killed. And Henry Gallagher was assigned to lead the convoy there. They arrived right after the riot was over, basically. It was winding down, but he was assigned to be in charge of security, the security patrol for James Meredith, and keeping him safe for his time at the university. So, and he's this, you know, young guy who just had no idea, he waking up that day, where he would be in a day and a half. And he did a great job. He kept him alive and worked with him. And this is really Henry's story. Although James Meredith is placed inside of this play, and you get to hear James Meredith, the character of James Meredith, talk about his philosophy, his ideology. It's really about all the hustling and all the craziness that went around. He was the eye of the hurricane, and everything else was a hurricane around him. And the country was up in arms about it. You know, it was insane, but you know what? It made a difference. So this is a story about a guy. He wrote this book. It's called James Meredith and the Ole Miss Riot, and Henry Gallagher did. And that was in 2012, I think the book came out. So as an older man looking back on his life and recreating these events to write this book. And so I guess you could say the play is kind of like, it's almost as if he's writing the book in front of the audience. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Long explanation, but it's full of a lot of stuff.
So you're going to be taking the audience back to 1962, the throes of the civil rights movement, Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What were the Beatles up to in 1962? They were just getting going. I mean, what
they were still
what a
in the
heady
cavern.
right. Fantastic. Yeah. And Pierce, have you done a lot of work with history theater?
I've done eight shows with them, something like that. I'm always playing real people. It's really strange. I started off playing Garrison Keillor in his first play. And this is when I moved to town.
Did you do like a method thing for that?
You listen to the Prairie Home a lot. And, you know, I had just moved from New York and I'd been here about a year, maybe a year and a half. And a friend of mine introduced me to Ron Peluso. He said, because I couldn't get any work. You know, the Minnesota scene is kind of like very polite, but not super, hi, you're from out of town. Come on in and work with us. You know, it just wasn't that way when I got here anyway. So finally, I wasn't getting much work, but I met Ron. And he said, come in and sit down with me and just talk. It was like a no-brainer. And after a half an hour, he said, listen, we're doing this workshop of this new Garrison Keillor play for Raw Stages in the spring, and I'd like you to be a part of that. And I said, oh my God, I would love that, you know. And then he calls me up a week later, and he goes, and we'd like you to play Garrison Keillor. And he'll be there in the room with us the whole time.
And, no pressure at all.
And I was a Prairie Home fan. I wasn't like a maniac about it, but I loved what he did, you know. And he's the kind of guy who's more comfortable talking to 3,000 people than to one person. Sue Scott, who was, you know, in his troupe, said, the last place you want to be with Garrison Keillor is alone in an elevator, you know. And so talking to him one-on-one was kind of challenging, but we had a great time, man. It turned into a full play, and I did it. And then I played LBJ in a play called All the Way, and then the sequel called The Great Society. I played basically Tim O'Brien in a production of The Things They Carried about Vietnam. Mm. And I've been in a couple other historical plays, you know, about Gordon Parks and Melvin Carter, who's a Minnesota legend, and playing various different people in that. And and then another play that was about a dance marathon in Minnesota, and I played the MC. I don't know if he was a real guy or not, but yeah, I represent Great. the real folks.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, and all of those things, those are all things that I really resonate with strongly. Tim O'Brien, a friend of mine, studied with him under him at San Marcos down in Texas. And obviously great, great Minnesotan.
Great writer, man. Just great. We're going to bring that back sometime in the future.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fascinating. How do you go about? And I'm the resident playwright. I mean, and Amanda.
Oh, okay.
And Amanda and Mari, you know, are actors. Mari's a playwright. Okay. But I try to ask actor questions, right? So
yeah.
How do you? This is a really 101, but I love asking. And it's sort of like, how did you get ready to do? Let's start with the show that you're doing now. And also, by the way, can we get the dates and everything in? I can.
Oh yeah, right, absolutely. Yeah. You know what? Let's see. It opens the 16th of March at the History Theater, which is this coming Saturday, and runs till Sunday, April 7th. And right. I've got little tabs up here that I can give you any information you need.
Sure. Yeah. And just for the listeners, whether you're listening on the old timey radio, 94.1 FM Frogtown Radio, or you're listening online, I'm seeing here a unique assignment March 16th through April 7th at the Great History Theater by Harrison David Rivers, directed by Richard D. Thompson. You're not going to want to miss that. That sounds fascinating.
Yes, Rick Thompson is the new artistic director. This is his first full season. He's taken over from Ron Peluso, and he's doing wonderful. I love working with him. We're having, you guys, I got to tell you, we're having so much fun in the room with this play. It's such a good vibe in the rehearsal room. It's translated to the theater with the whole tech crew, all the designers. It's we're really busting our butts on this one, so...
And not a musical, not a musical,
not a musical. No, not a musical. In fact, yeah, there's music in it, but okay. No, there's not a musical.
Well, and so let me return to the question I was asking, which is for this, how have you been preparing for the role?
Well, the first thing I did was read the book, James Meredith and the Ole Miss Riot, A Soldier's Story by Henry Gallagher, which is his... Harrison has really kind of captured the spirit of the book, where he's got a notebook that are actually in the library at Ole Miss, that were these little 10-cent spiral notebooks you get at Woolworths in 1962, right? And he would write down all this stuff just in case. I mean, look, they were looking for suspicious people. They were looking for agitators from out of town. Not necessarily. They weren't so worried about the Ole Miss students as they were about, because I'm trying to remember his name. There was a former general who was in charge of the operation at Little Rock, and he retired from the army, and he was a complete white supremacist, and he called on white supremacist people from all over the country, you know, collect in Oxford for this night, because this is going to happen. So it was a call to arms. So he was looking for suspicious individuals who might take a shot at Meredith. And he had to write down license plate numbers, cars, what people look like, as well as just all their plans and activities and way to go. So he was able to reconstruct all this again through his firsthand notes, as well as through commentary from other people, you know, who were there from different points of view, other people in his battalion. James Meredith, other people in the Justice Department and soldiers who were there. But he comments, so he goes back to the past, but he also comments in the present, right? So in this play, there's four characters. There's 73-year-old Henry Gallagher, who I play. Then there's 23-year-old Henry Gallagher. And then there's James Meredith, who's played by James Williams. And then there's... another actor, Kevin Brown, plays a whole bunch of different parts, you know, soldiers and stuff like that. And a guy named Kevin Fanshaw is playing young Henry Gallagher. Let me get his name in there.
I know those guys from the international Kevin group chat. We're all in there. Yeah.
Okay. So. Good. So we all. It's a big ensemble piece where very often at the History Theater, I've been in a lot of plays where a character will say, when I was 17, and then they'll walk into a living room where their parents are and they pretend to be 17. This is very different. It's on a minimalist stage using video effects or panels that show images on them and sound and lights, but we all tell the story. Even though I'm kind of one of the narrators, we all become narrators. And it's about memory and how memory kind of comes out of the fog and retreats back into it. So, yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, looking at the website, Henry Gallagher is still with us. And he's going to be joining you guys for a panel discussion. During the development process, were you able to talk with him and work with him? And
yeah, well, getting back to your question, the first thing I did was read the book. And then the next thing I did, we did a couple workshops and we talked a lot about it. And then finally I got in touch with Henry. And Henry and I just hit it off right off the bat. He loves to talk. And so he would go, for 5 minutes. And he goes, okay, I'm done talking. You start. And that's the kind of conversation you have with him. But he, yeah, I've watched him numerous times on different videos. And there's so much video to watch about this, documentaries. There's a 30 for 30 on ESPN. That's incredible story about the Ole Miss team that actually had their best record that year while the unrest was going on the campus. And Henry's in that, you know, Henry gets around and talks about this a lot. So he will be here for a panel on opening night. And then, well, James Meredith is still around too, by the way. He's in, I think, 90 or 91 now, and he is not able to travel right now, but his wife is going to be there on opening night. So
that's wonderful.
We got some good people.
Yeah, that's one of the fun things of history theater. I mean, it's history, but it's Minnesota history principally. And so, you know, the state isn't, you know, as constituted as Minnesota. It's not 1,000 years old. So you got a lot of living people.
Yeah. And that's kind of a challenge when you're portraying somebody or the spirit of somebody, you know, because I don't look like Henry. I'm a little bit younger than him. Henry's like 5'8 and 170 or 150. And I'm like 6'2 and 210, you know, but I get the way he thinks. I like the way he writes. I get his sense of humor. And like I said, there's definitely a connection between us that we've established. And we've had a couple really long conversations about just little things. In fact, I'm about to send him an email and said, Henry, are you the kind of guy who creases his blue jeans and corduroys or lets them hang loose? You know, I want to know if he's like, if he's carried that military discipline with him. But he was only in the Army for 2 years. And when he got out, he moved on to other things. So
yeah, that's a really serious inflection point in history to be involved in.
It is, and it's a little known story. Well, not little known, but not as well known as others, perhaps, you know, like the March in Selma and all that, you know, but a significant, yes, a very significant moment in civil rights history, told from a white person's point of view, which is different.
White guy from Minnesota, huh?
A white guy from Minnesota. You can't get any whiter than that.
I don't know. Maybe Utah.
Yeah,
but maybe, you know, who's keeping track, right?
Who's keeping track?
I mean, and of course, an Ole Miss is a big, obviously still a big football school. I mean, they take football. Yeah. Football's a religion down there. So that's crazy. Absolutely. About the 30 for 30. I had no idea. I'm gonna have to check that out.
I think it's called The Ghosts of Ole Miss, and it's in the second season, and it's I just watched it not too long ago. It's episode 5 or something like that.
But
and Meredith is in it as well. He gets interviewed a lot.
When I think of Oxford, Mississippi, I always think of Faulkner, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
That's mentioned in the play.
Right. It sort of has to be. Right.
Yeah. The birthplace of William Faulkner. Of course, Henry went down south on a hitchhiking trip to escape the Minnesota winter. When he was a young kid, when, you know, he was like in high school, and he made his way, he passed through Tupelo on the way to Memphis, and he wrote about it in a lit class later on about how it was a highlight passing through Elvis's hometown as a highlight. And his professor's like, I can't believe you were that close to Oxford and you didn't stop by William Faulkner's birthplace.
You know? Yeah. It's like
when he got there on this detail, he drove there. It's in the book. He drove to Faulkner's house. Faulkner had just died. And black gardener or housekeeper was outside. And he pulls up in this Jeep with a couple guys in the Jeep in full Army uniform. And the guy's like, And he just said hello to him, had some small talk with him, and then just said, and then we left because I didn't need to make a big deal about it. But I could say, yes, I went to William Faulkner's house. Strange how you think of something like that here.
I've always wanted to see that little town. At some point, I'm going to have to get down there. I mean, to me, it just seems like it must be one of these iconic kind of, you know, we have these like sort of leafy, small college towns. They're kind of like one of the best kept secrets in the United States. Yeah. I've been to a couple of them. I've been to Kenyon. What on earth is that? I've been to Sewanee. Are you familiar with Sewanee?
No, I've heard of it, but
just surreal. I mean, I'm going to go on a little tangent here, but they call it the University of the South. And Tennessee Williams left his estate to Sewanee. So they have a writers' conference where the playwrights get to go hang out with the real writers. And so you can get a Tennessee Williams scholarship and you get a little bit of Tennessee's money. And I got one of those 1 year. And that campus is bizarre because it's an Episcopalian campus or whatever. It's an Episcopalian school. They sent their architect over to like Oxford and Cambridge and said, we want that.
Oh, you
know?
Yeah.
And so you've got like, that's very, very strange. In any case, Pierce, where do you hail from? Where are you from originally?
I'm from Philadelphia.
Oh, beautiful Philadelphia.
Yeah, I know. And there's
beautiful. I'm from the beautiful land of the cheesesteak and water and the Eagles.
And the hoagies.
And the hoagies.
Have your water and hoagies.
Water and hoagies. Here you go,
down there.
Yeah. Amanda, you live there too. Yeah, yeah. Go Birds. You live there right, Amanda? Yeah.
I lived there for about a year, and that was like post pandemic, so it was mostly for family reasons. But
Philly's a good town.
It really is. It's good for theater, and it's got an energy and a character all its own. Like there's no other Philadelphia.
No, there is no place like it. Yeah, I love it. I've lived all over the city. I lived in South Philly for 10 years. In fact, I play a little character because I kind of switch into a couple characters aside from Henry, and I give him a little Philly flavor, a soldier, you know?
Nice. Yes. Yeah, yeah. I love it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
very cool.
Well, speaking of playing real people on stage or portraying real people on stage, and what happens when you can't talk to them? So, you know, you said you played LBJ. I'm just curious how you sort of found your way into his head and, you know, mannerisms, or to, you know, find out if he creased his jeans
his
or
no,
slacks.
You know, you just dive deep. Listen, I'm the kind of actor I have been. I mean, I've been doing this for 40 years, right? And there reached a point, I think when I was in my 30s, where I just really got serious about going crazy, about getting inside of stuff and by any means necessary, kind of understanding a role, which I wasn't trying to be gratuitous or trying to go look at me and what I do. I was just simply trying to not be a person saying the words, just saying the words. You know, I wanted to feel things, and we're successful at that some of the time, but not all the time. We're not as good. Yeah, I mean, I'm not as good as I want to be all the time. I'm never really satisfied with where I'm at, but all I know to do is jump into it like head first. And I didn't like history when I was in school, when I was in high school, but I love history. And so when I played LBJ, I went to Texas, man. I went to Austin. I went to the town where he was born. I sat.
Heck, hell yeah.
I sat.
Did you go to the big library?
Yeah, I went to the big library, did all that. But I actually went to the, you know, the little tiny house that he was a little kid in, and his grandmother's house that he talks about hiding under the porch, or she told stories about hiding under the porch from Native Americans, you know, who were nearby, you know, and just these fantasies that he has in the play. And so I kind of retraced his steps. And of course I went to the ranch and just walked around and saw all that stuff and wrote about it, and then went to the library and then watched a million. There's so many videos about LBJ. My father, on the other hand, was a total hardcore right-wing conservative Nixon lover. Right. So I grew up in a house full of elephants. So he would be spinning in his grave if he knew that I played LBJ. But and LBJ, he was a complicated dude. You know, he was a profane man who would pretty much do anything to get what he wanted. He exercised power freely. He intimidated people. So there was, and if you read like Doris Goodwin's book about him, or Master of the Senate, you know, you find out stuff about him that you're just like, whoa, man, I can't believe that happened, that I can't talk about on this show. You know, but he was pretty
sure.
But he also, he was an American original. He did a lot of extraordinary stuff while he was in office. And so you learn to love them, and you learn all, and you get to, I mean, that Robert Shankin as a playwright gave me stuff to do that gives anybody who's playing LBJ in that play stuff to do that just opens the door. You know, it's like he's on the phone and he's getting fit by a tailor. He's like, give me a little room down there, boy. You know, this kind of stuff. And so you just listen to the way he talks, and you, I don't know.
Did you get to work with Robert Shankin? Because I met him down at Texas Shankin, because that's where I went to grad school. So I know kind of that. Yeah, yeah.
You know, I know Bob Shankin from 1982 when I started out as a apprentice at a theater, and he was a playwright, and he wrote a play called The Survivalist, about a one man show about a survivalist, and another play that was at this theater, People's Light and Theater Company. So I was a 23-year-old hanging out when he was there. But cool. I didn't get to talk to him this time, you know.
Is he a Philly guy too?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think he's from the Midwest.
Okay.
But I might be wrong about that. Maybe he's from the South. I don't know. Maybe some.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, in All the Way, very famously, didn't Cranston. Cranston did it on the HBO. And
did it on Broadway and then on HBO. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
I didn't do any. Check that out. Arena stage with the wonderful Ed Giroux.
Oh,
playing,
yeah.
LBJ. He's just a treasure. I love him so much. And I think I'm much more interested in watching actors who, you know what the smell of the grandma's porch is, you know, for LBJ, than getting his, you know, stature perfectly right and his voice perfectly correct.
Yeah, you kind of just get that bullish thing going on, and then circumstances are happening around you, mm-hmm. and you're insecure, like he is, and you're like, and so you strike out like he did. And Shankin gave me the words to say. Let me just tell you this funny little story. I always want to know what, in fact, I haven't found this out about Henry, although it's not, he talks about music in the book, about hearing Dixie and I Can't Stop Loving You playing in the same neighborhood, coming out of the windows. And he's like, you know, these people, they'll listen to their music, but they won't let them go to their school, you know. So this contrast is constantly going on there. But I often like to know what kind of music a character listens to. And so I couldn't find out with LBJ. And when I was doing a tour of the ranch, they get to his bedroom, and Lady Bird, he would have meetings at 4 a.m. People would show up and he would be talking to people, and she's like, I can't stand this. So she built her own bedroom and she moved back there. Well, LBJ had all these switches on the walls and speakers, and the guy goes, these are for his audio system and listening to stuff, and he would play music and stuff. And I said, what was his favorite music? And the guy said, Muzak.
Oh no.
Which really made sense to me. You know, imagine like raindrops keep falling on my head. You know, like some benign thing playing, because he didn't read a lot. He didn't go to movies or plays and stuff unless he was forced to. So he was just, he had this calming thing in the background, this innocuous music playing. Well, and that said so much to me, you know.
That's
so
fascinating. Yeah. If I was ever president, I would definitely not go to the theater. There's a bad history of presidents in the theater.
Very true.
Yeah. I just want to circle back. I just want to get it right. You know, the great Robert Shankin, he was born in North Carolina, but then
it appears
he grew up in Austin, Texas, and is a proud alum of the great University of Texas at Austin. There you go. Book
of Longhorns, right?
That's it. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, a lot of fun. Good football school. Little football school there, down there.
My nephews went there.
Is that right?
Yeah, and one of them still lives there. So.
Okay. Yeah, fantastic. Good town. Good town. Good little theater scene, and very eccentric little theater scene down there.
Yeah.
Although the tech bros have sort of taken over. I gotta go back. Pierce, how long have you been in the Twin Cities? How long have you been in?
I've been here for 14 years in August. This coming August, it'll be 14 years. So.
And what brought you out this way?
My wife. We met in Philadelphia, and she was a, we both worked on a travel show for the Discovery Channel in the 90s. She was a producer. I was one of the hosts. We traveled all over the world together, and we sat next to each other on a flight to the Philippines for 18 hours, and I fell in love with her. I know that sounds really hokey. I was already in a relationship with somebody else.
Wait. So you're on a long flight with your not then your wife, right?
My boss, basically.
Your boss. You're telling me you're that person, and I know we just met, but you're that person who just started talking to somebody else on the plane, and you never stopped talking. You're still talking.
We met 5 minutes in the office, and some people kept saying, "Oh, you're gonna love Stephanie. You're gonna love her. You guys are gonna get along great." And we met, and I was like, "Bang," you know. Mm. And I was in a long distance relationship with somebody, and I hadn't seen them for a while, and this happened very slowly, but eventually, we told each other we were in love with each other, and then we got married, and. Lived in New York, lived in LA, had a kid. So what was I, where was I going with that? Why was I?
I was just asking about Minnesota.
Anyway, so eventually we moved back to New York, and we had this little apartment in Hell's Kitchen, 430 square feet. And at one point she just said, "I can't do it anymore. I don't want to live in Philly, Jersey, Connecticut, Brooklyn, Queens. I forget upstate New York. I want to go home." And I'm told that all Minnesotans go home eventually.
It's really, really, really hard. I met my fiance. I'm not Minnesotan. I'm originally from North Dakota, but I think they've adopted me. I don't know, Amanda, you're you know, official. So
you're
I don't know. Yeah, she's the real article.
Yeah, okay. I spent about eight years on the East Coast, almost nine, and I came back home.
And you came back home. And Mari, you're from Minnesota as well?
I'm not, but actually my mother was born in St. Cloud.
Oh, okay. So you got a connection.
Yeah. So a lot of Minnesotan family, and I mean, they lived there for years, and I have family that's there now, but I think, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, things change, but it's still so idyllic when you compare it to somewhere like New York City or Philly. And I mean, you mentioned your tiny apartment. I'm in a 450 like square foot apartment right now.
You got it.
And I think back to the apartment that I lived in Uptown when I did live in Minneapolis.
Yep.
You miss the space.
You want to weep, don't you?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, we don't have to try convince Mari. Pierce is going to do it for us to try.
There you go.
I'll be back.
Give her the old LBJ.
Minnesota, you have not seen the last.
Yeah, and Mari, baby, you just come back here. We got a basement apartment you can live in here in SLP. We'll take care of you.
I met my
fiance. You know, I showed up in my University of Minnesota hoodie, go Gophers. She went to the U. I was in a relationship with somebody else, kind of not, you know, in and out. And it was just like, we're going back, aren't we? We're going back. Yeah. We're done. And there's a sense here. It's a vortex, you know. And
we had this kid who had a corner. He didn't have a bedroom. We found this IKEA bed that just fit right perfectly in this corner, and he had this kind of like, I think it was like a rainbowy kind of awning thing that we put over it so we could get a little privacy. You know, when you have a kid in New York, they're totally good till fifth grade. And then after that, it becomes warfare, just trying to get him in schools. And she didn't want to deal with that. And he was in kindergarten. And she said, "I just want to be near my folks. They're getting older. My sister lives there." Yeah. So I had to go through therapy for a couple of years. Because let me tell you, on our first date, after all these, a year of extended flirting and stuff, we finally went on a date to see Independence Day on the 4th of July. And she was living out, I don't know if... Amanda, if you remember the town of Manayunk, which is outside of Philly.
I absolutely do.
Okay, so she was living in Manayunk at the time, and we were making out on the street. And she said, "Listen, before this goes any further, I just want to tell you someday I want to live in, move back to Minnesota." I was like, "Sure, babe, anything you want, let's just go inside and continue this conversation, you know?"
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
It came back to haunt me. She said, "I told you And I'm like, you're right. But things were going well for me in New York at the time. I was on Broadway. I was got a little TV action going. And I had to do some therapy. But for a kid, I think it was a great thing. And the ironic thing is that our kid has never forgotten New York. We've gone back there many times since he was 6 years old. And so they feel like they're home when they're in New York. You know, they're like, this is my place. So
there's something to be said about having, you know, a little connection to New York City or a little connection to LA, and then also having the Minnesota connection. You can live your entire life out here and have a very full and rich life. But if you're in the arts, if you're creative, there's something about, hey, you know, if you know your way around New York, you can get a lot of traction, and you can appreciate both places for what they are. Yeah, Amanda.
Yeah. And I mean, as an artist or as a storyteller, I just love people and hearing their stories and how they ended up there. And when you're in a place like New York or, you know, Boston or Philly, I mean, people are from all over, and it's so crazy how, you know, how people's lives intersect for just, it could be a day, it could be 14 years, 15 years, and how they ended up there and where they come from and who they know. And you'll find this random connection that, oh, you know, so-and-so. And it's, you know, there, what is it? There's like 12 million people in New York City. And then, you know, the random Minnesotans that you haven't seen since high school, you'll see on,
you walk in,
you know,
totally.
It's crazy. Yeah.
When we were
it.
Living in New York, they they broadcast the Christmas concert from St. Olaf in like three or four movie theaters. And my wife, live, like a live simulcast or something. And my wife went there, and it was packed with Minnesotans in their Christmas sweaters down like in Union Square.
That's, you know, awesome.
Yeah, crazy, right?
Oh man, they're Gatsby maxing out in New York City.
yeah. But I would venture to say that all the machinations we do as theater people to write plays, to perform in them, to direct them, and our careers and all this stuff, when we're on our deathbeds, we're going to be telling stories about these randos that we met, right? And like these, just the stuff backstage and the stuff, you know, that happened in the cracks between our productions or my greatest performance or whatever, you know?
It's like, life.
Life. Nobody's going to remember that. They're going to remember, you know, all these randos. And that's what I love. That's what I love about
life. I love it so much.
That's great.
Too.
We got
that's
a show so title great. Too. Yeah.
The randos.
All these randos.
I'm also a connector, and I like to connect people. I like to, it's not something I consciously do. It just happens around me. So I've introduced Henry to another veteran named Jerry Myron, who worked with us on Things They Carried. And they come from, they were both in Vietnam, but two completely different random things, but they're about the same age. And Jerry's going to be there opening night too. So they're going to get to meet, and they've been in touch, you know? And so it's like, there's all these little connections that shoot off the work that you do. And that's what helps you invest more in that work. So I think that is helping me invest in this role and believing in this play, you know?
Well, I want to ask the question that sort of leads into your deep background, the deep Pierce Bunting lore, right? Like, how did you start acting? When did you know you wanted to make a career of it? All of that.
Yeah. I was definitely a clown growing up. And like I said, my father was this kind of conservative Republican, but he had a sense of humor. My mother had a real sense of humor, and our whole family did. But I would run up to get, I was the youngest of five, and I just wasn't getting enough attention. So I'd run up to her closet and put on her girdle and bra over my clothes and run down after dinner and like do some little dance. And mom would be, wow. My dad would just have his head in his hands, you know, oh my God, what is this kid? and I acted out in many different ways at school. I was always the one to kind of be a troublemaker. And I got sent to a all boys school in seventh grade, not as a punishment, but my parents wanted me to go there. And I did not want to go to an all boys school. I just, you know, so I was miserable, and I had to wear a coat and tie, and the colors were maroon and gold, which I know are the Gophers colors, you know, but But I just don't like that color combination.
Oh, you're in the wrong state, buddy.
I know, I know. Someone's gonna come and throw
you,
eggs in my
you
house.
Take right? that, you take that back.
Wait a minute, Sky Uma,
come on, what are you doing?
But seriously, I mean, I don't know. I just never got that color combo. But it was just insult to injury, and it was a bunch of serious-minded students. But in seventh grade in middle school, auditioned for a play, and I found this kind of island of freakazoids who were at this school, who were older than me or my age, and the older guys, the upperclassmen, would treat me with respect like I was an equal, because we had this weird little culty thing that we did. And you know, I got to do a bunch of plays in high school, and then when I got out of high school, I moved to Boulder, Colorado, to get the hell out of Philly. And I was living out there in the late 70s and early 80s, freaking out, you know, just partying all the time and playing music. I thought I was going to be a songwriter. But I got to be 21. I didn't know what I was going to do. I kind of felt the need to start figuring something out. And a friend of mine was visiting and said, look in the paper, hey, they're having auditions at this community theater. You know, you used to like to do that. So I went and auditioned, and I got the part, and then I got another part, another part, another part. And then I knew I wanted to leave, so I auditioned for a summer program in New York at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, which is not a really reputable school, I don't think, but it had a summer program, and I went to it. And I worked in the Village, and I worked at the Figaro Cafe at night making cheese boards for Al Pacino, who was doing American Buffalo up the street. You know, I mean... Great it was play. An auspicious time. I lived in Dumbo before it became Dumbo with a bunch of jazz musicians. So I was like living around the theater then, but I wasn't really doing it. And then I got an apprenticeship at this theater in Philly. And as luck would have it, a week before this show opened, the main actor dropped out, and I just happened to be perfect for the role. And they gave it to me, and it was a hit show. And so that kind of, I got some more work out of that. Worked a bit for the next few years. And then I only was doing like four shows a year. And I just didn't really feel, I felt like I wanted to get submerged. So I auditioned for Yale Drama School. I hadn't gone to undergrad. I'd gotten accepted to Connecticut College, and I was going to go to the Eugene O'Neill Theatrical Boot Camp in Waterford. But my dad died when I was 18. It didn't work out. We didn't have the money. And I wanted to get the hell away from everything anyway. But Yale would, if they accept you, you don't need an undergraduate degree because it's conservatory training. So I got in to Yale, and I went to New Haven for 3 years.
That's a good school.
Yeah, it's a pretty good school. And we had a good time. I got steeped in realism, Chekhov, Ibsen, Strindberg, Shakespeare, some newer stuff, did a lot of original new plays at the Cabaret, and that you know, playwrights had written that were going to school there. Worked at the Rep a little bit. You know, and then I got sober. That was probably the biggest thing that happened to me. I had a bad cocaine addiction, and my father died of alcoholism, and I was just going that way. And when I was 31, I got sober, and I got kind of recommitted to what I was doing. And I think my work actually really got better then, you know. So I've had all these adventures, and I feel like I've made the most of them, but I'm not sure if I earned any one of them in the audition. But I certainly found myself, I look back and I go, look, I had a great career. I'm having a great career. I'm not a star, but I've been working as an actor. I was on Broadway in Mamma Mia, of all things. And I'm not even really a singer, but I was one of the dads. I was on tour for 2 years, and then I got the part on Broadway for 3 years, you know? That paid for a lot of stuff, you know? So yeah, it's just this. So why not go to Minnesota? Why not go to, who cares? My kid's at school now. I'm like ready to start traveling again, do some more work elsewhere.
Okay. You heard it here.
I mean, you're Ahab. You already have the white whale on the white way. So
yeah, right. I'd like to go back and do something a little more serious, but
you know what happens then. You know what happens to Ahab at the end of that book, Amanda? You know, that's I don't true. Know. We probably, yeah, yeah. No, yeah. That's fun. That's fun.
Yeah, you know, that's a truncated history of Pierce.
That was great, Pierce. And that was thank you for being so candid.
I got no problem sharing that.
No, you know, that's fantastic.
I'm heavily involved with the recovery community.
Sure.
I also during the pandemic, I got a. I took a course and got certified by the state to be a peer recovery coach, which is someone who helps people in early recovery find resources and to help them kind of find how they want to recover. So it's not strictly 12 steps, it's other things. And I've been able to practice that and be a sponsor to a couple people. And everywhere I turn, there are sober people. Everybody's there's so many sober actors in the business, you know, and we all have stories to tell from when we weren't sober. So, you know,
yeah. Like and stories that you can't remember the blackout stories
that other people remember,
Other people remember. Yeah. Don't love that. Maybe right. I know what you're talking about. How has your experience with addiction and recovery and the psychology of it informed your acting? Have you played roles where it comes in? Anything like that?
Yeah. I have played some roles of addicted people. I think the last one I played was somebody who was addicted to Oxy. It was a Christina Hamm play at the Playwright Center.
Oh, I know Christina from the Playwright Center.
Okay. It was a play called The Hollow. It was a scary thing that took place in New Orleans. And I went kind of into that. Of course, I was long sober at that point, but we got I called the guys. I was on this series on HBO called Boardwalk Empire.
Sure.
It takes place in the 20s. And I called the props guy and said, listen, what do you guys use for cocaine? You know, or for powders that people snort. And he goes, oh, it's just, you know, it's like xylitol or something. I'll send you a thing. And he sent me a thing of it. And so I would lay these lines out, which was very weird because it's, excuse me, it's a, you don't want to mess around with that stuff. You know what I mean? You don't like to pretend to snort something. It's a very physical experience for me. So, but I was able to keep a distance. I was going to meetings, and it sold it pretty well, and it actually helped get my head into that guy a little bit. But I don't know. I think, you know, I wish I could be a better listener. I feel like I've got a lot of empathy. I'm a part of the world again, and... I feel for things. I don't know how to say it without, it sounds kind of corny, but I think I just became right-headed where I wasn't trying to be special. I was just trying to do my job to the best of my ability and be a good person, which is all part of recovery, you know? Yeah. And so good things, you know, you practice that stuff in your life and you get opportunities and you can choose to take them or not. But
yeah,
you know, stuff will happen.
You start living a little differently when you don't have that cheat out where if things go off the rails, you know, there's a bottle or there's a pill or something. If that's gone, you just have to in the moment, in the day, face it. You're going to have a bad day, but there's no way out. Right.
Right.
So you got to confront it. If you have that cheat out, it changes everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or if it's not even a cheat out, it's like, no, that's the thing that's calling. That's what you're really living for.
Sure,
I was not living to be a good friend or a good partner or a good actor or anything. I was living to score some more coke so I could just be alone in a room and buzz out and go, God, everything's great, but I'm absolutely doing nothing. I thought I'm being so unpredictable, but I was the most predictable person in the world. Now I am truly unpredictable.
Yeah, we I can tell even from 45 minutes.
This whole story has been unpredictable.
I kind of shoot around a lot, and I'm sorry.
Maybe I should talk more about this.
That's what this show is for.
Yeah, that's what this is. What it's about. Good. Yeah,
but really, it is important to care about what you do in life, you know, and all the different things that you do. And if you're just acting like you're caring, then you're not doing yourself any favors, right? So I really care about doing a good job in whatever I do. I work part-time at Trader Joe's, you guys. I care about like facing the shelves, making that dairy box look good, you know, because I don't have work all the time. You know, when you're an older white guy these days, the work situation is changing, and absolutely appropriately so. And so I find myself having to get creative and do, I'm doing podcasts, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, you know, and supporting whatever work is being done. And every now and then, you know, we're developing a show about Sinclair Lewis.
Sweet.
At the Illusion. Sauk Center from up in the Midlands of Minnesota, who wrote Main Street. Thank you.
I loved that book, and I know
he's written a lot of books.
Some people really hate it or just think it's so trivial, but I love it so very much.
He wrote this. He was a sensation of the 20s. Yeah, it's a great play actually that Bob Beveridge has done the adaptation of, and we started working on it during the pandemic, and we did a workshop last year, and we're going to do another one in April. So there's a lot of stories.
Give me a call if you need an actor.
Okay, man.
Yeah, for real. Yeah, I mean, it looks like Sinclair Lewis also went to Yale. What are the odds?
He
did. What are the odds? And a fellow Yale man.
What are the odds?
That's your in.
Yeah, right.
Can I just tell you this kind of personal thing? I don't know if you've noticed, because the audience, of course, the listening audience doesn't see anything, but I have these spots all over my forehead right now, okay? The reason I have these spots is because a dermatologist gave me this cream a year ago and said, listen, I want you to put this on your forehead. It'll just alleviate any possible precancerous stuff, you know, as you get older. So I put it on while I was in rehearsals for this. And I thought, you just put it on for 5 days. And well, it turns out the reaction comes after the 5 days. And it's looking so much better than it was. But I looked like, now this is the bridge to Sinclair Lewis. Sinclair Lewis had a horrible acne, and his father was a doctor, and they treated it in the early 1900s with radiation. And most of the pictures you see of him have been doctored, but if you see a real picture of him, his face is ravaged. And we actually did full makeup for him for this other Sinclair Lewis project, which was the beginning. But my wife said, listen, you do this play, you just put that cream all over your face, honey, for like 5 days. You're going to be good for a 3-week run. It's going to be great.
You're going to look so perfect and fantastic.
Yeah. Yes. I am ashamed that I do not know more about Sinclair Lewis. He won the Nobel Prize. He's the first American writer to win the Nobel Prize.
The Nobel Prize. That's right.
Yeah.
He also won the Pulitzer, but he turned it down because he felt they were awarding him for a body of work and he didn't want that. He wanted it for Main Street. And he's like,
come on. I didn't know.
Yeah. He wrote Elmer Gantry.
Yes.
He also wrote a great book called, I'm too into this play to remember. King's Blood Royal, towards the end of his career. That was about racism. And it's extraordinary. It's about a white guy who finds out that he's got that 1% and his town in Minnesota turns on him.
Oof.
And he starts identifying as a black person and starts hanging out in the black side of town. And it's insane and beautifully written. And he ended up dead in a hotel room in Rome.
In Rome, I'm reading. He drank himself to death too. Yeah, yeah. Don't do drugs, kids.
There's another one. Don't do drugs. Help. You do, get help, get sober, your world will open up. And I'm sure there's lots of kids listening to this. So
there's at least one, I'll tell you. Take my word. I need to hear it.
Okay, good.
This is Mouthing Off from Bad Mouth Theater Company with the great Pierce Bunting. That was a really fun time, Pierce. You're welcome to come on anytime. You got something to promote, always come on, open door.
I would love that. I would love that. I have your email address and I'm going to take that, you know.
We really mean it. Yeah. Where can people find you? Let's hit the dates again one more time for the show.
Yeah. The History Theater in downtown St. Paul. Okay. Downtown St. Paul, just a block away from the Fitzgerald Theater, right down from the state capitol, is the History Theater. And a unique assignment runs from March 16th, this coming Saturday. Actually, previews start on the 14th and runs till April 7th. I believe it's usually Thursday through Sunday. And it's a great cast.
And Henry Gallagher will be there March 17th to speak. So if you're interested in seeing
him, he'll be there for
a
panel. He'll be there for a panel from 3 to 4:30 or 5 or something on opening night. And then he'll be there to speak after the matinee on Sunday the 17th. And I can't wait to meet him. So, okay.
The you great Pierce Bunting, yes. And we are Bad Mouth Theater Company, badmouthtc.com. You know where to find us. If you want to come on the show, you have something going on around the Twin Cities or beyond, badmouthtc@gmail.com. Thanks again, Pierce. Amanda, Mari,
peace.
Take care. Bye.
Peace out.
Yep, later.